Chapter 20. Irene Stag has been found sufficient to propagate the defect through a whole forest. Why should we wonder at the greatest consequences, from so many loppings and mutilations to which the ears of our fathers and our own have been of late so much exposed? It is true, indeed, that while this island of ours was under the dominion of grace, many endeavors were made to improve the growth of ears once more among us. The proportion of largeness was not only looked upon as an ornament of the outward man, but as a type of grace in the inward. Besides, it is held by naturalists that if there be a protuberancy of parts in the superior region of the body, as in the ears and nose, there must be a parity also in the inferior. And therefore in that truly pious age the males in every assembly, according as they were gifted, appeared very forward in exposing their ears to view, and the regions about them, because Hippocrates 151b tells us that, when the vein behind the ear happens to be cut, a man becomes a eunuch, and the females were nothing backwarder in beholding and edifying by them. Whereof those who had already used the means looked about them with great concern, in hopes of conceiving a suitable offspring by such a prospect. Others, who stood candidates for benevolence, found there a plentiful choice, and were sure to fix upon such as discovered the largest ears, that the breed might not dwindle between them. Lastly, the devouter sisters, who looked upon all extraordinary dilatations of that member as protrusions of zeal, or spiritual excrescences, were sure to honor every head they sat upon, as if they had been cloven tongues, but especially that of the preacher, whose ears were usually of the prime magnitude, which upon that account he was very frequent, and exact in exposing with all advantages to the people in his rhetorical paroxysms. Turning sometimes to hold forth the one, and sometimes to hold forth the other, from which custom the whole operation of preaching is to this very day among their professors styled by the phrase of holding forth. Such was the progress of the saints for advancing the size of that member, and it is thought the success would have been every way answerable, if in process of time a cruel king had not arose, who raised a bloody persecution against all ears above a certain standard, 152, upon which some were glad to hide their flourishing sprouts in a black border, others crept wholly under a periwig. Some were slit, others cropped, and a great number sliced off to the stumps. But of this more hereafter in my general history of ears, which I design very speedily to bestow upon the public. From this brief survey of the falling state of ears in the last age, and the small care had to advance their ancient growth in the present, it is manifest how little reason we can have to rely upon a hold so short, so weak, and so slippery. And that whoever desires to catch mankind fast must have recourse to some other methods. Now he that will examine human nature with circumspection enough may discover several handles, whereof the six 152b senses afford one apiece, beside a great number that are screwed to the passions, and some few riveted to the intellect. Among these last, curiosity is one, and of all others affords the firmest grasp. Curiosity, that spur in the side, that bridle in the mouth, that ring in the nose of a lazy, an impatient, and a grunting reader. By this handle it is that an author should seize upon his readers, which as soon as he hath once compassed, all resistance and struggling are in vain, and they become his prisoners as close as he pleases, till weariness or dullness force him to let go his grip. And therefore I, the author of this miraculous treatise, having hitherto, beyond expectation, maintained by the aforesaid handle a firm hold upon my gentle readers, it is with great reluctance that I am at length compelled to remit my grasp, leaving them in the perusal of what remains to that natural ascendancy inherent in the tribe. I can only assure thee, courteous reader, for both our comforts, that my concern is altogether equal to thine, for my unhappiness in losing or mislaying among my papers the remaining part of these memoirs, which consisted of accidents, turns, and adventures, b. both new, agreeable, and surprising, and therefore calculated in all due points to the delicate taste of this our noble age. But alas, with my utmost endeavors I have been able only to retain a few of the heads, under which there was a full account how Peter got a protection out of the king's bench, and of a reconcilement between Jack and him, upon a design they had in a certain rainy night, to trepan brother Martin into a sponging house, and there strip him to the skin. How Martin, with much ado, showed them both a fair pair of heels. How a new warrant came out against Peter, upon which Jack left him in the lurch, stole his protection, and made use of it himself. How Jack's tatters came into fashion in court and city. How he got upon a great horse, and ate custard 153. But the particulars of all these, with several others which have now slid out of my memory, are lost beyond all hopes of recovery. For which misfortune, leaving my readers to condole with each other as far as they shall find it to agree with their several constitutions, but conjuring them by all the friendship that has passed between us, from the title page to this, not to proceed so far as to injure their healths for an accident past remedy, I now go on to the ceremonial part of an accomplished writer, and therefore by a courtly modern least of all others to be omitted. The conclusion. Going too long is a cause of abortion as effectual, though not so frequent, as going too short, and holds true especially in the labors of the brain. Well fare the heart of that noble Jesuit 155, who first adventured to confess in print that books must be suited to their several seasons, like dress, and diet, and diversions. And better fare our noble notion for refining upon this among other French modes. I am living fast, to see the time when a book that misses its tide shall be neglected as the moon by day, or like mackerel a week after the season. No man has more nicely observed our climate than the bookseller who bought the copy of this work. He knows to a tittle what subjects will best go off in a dry year, and which it is proper to expose foremost, when the weather-glass has fallen to much rain. When he had seen this treatise, and consulted his almanac upon it, he gave me to understand that he had manifestly considered the two principal things, which were the bulk and the subject, and found it would never take, but after a long vacation, and then only in case it should happen to be a hard year for turnips. Upon which I desired to know, considering my urgent necessities, what he thought might be acceptable this month. He looked westward and said, "I doubt we shall have a bit of bad weather. However, if you could prepare some pretty little banter but not in verse, or a small treatise upon it, it would run like wildfire. But if it hold up, I have already hired an author to write something against Dr. Bentley, which I am sure will turn to account." At length we agreed upon this expedient, that when a customer comes for one of these, and desires in confidence to know the author, he will tell him very privately as a friend, naming whichever of the wits shall happen to be that week in the vogue, and if Durfee's last play should be in course, I had as lieve he may be the person as Congreve. This I mention, because I am wonderfully well acquainted with the present relish of courteous readers, and have often observed, with singular pleasure, that a fly driven from a honey pot will immediately, with very good appetite, alight and finish his meal on an excrement. I have one word to say upon the subject of profound writers, who are grown very numerous of late, and I know very well the judicious world is resolved to list me in that number. I conceive, therefore, as to the business of being profound, that it is with writers as with wells. A person with good eyes can see to the bottom of the deepest, provided any water be there, and that often when there is nothing in the world at the bottom besides dryness and dirt, though it be but a yard and half underground, it shall pass, however, for wondrous deep, upon no wiser a reason than because it is wondrous dark. I am now trying an experiment very frequent among modern authors, which is to write upon nothing, when the subject is utterly exhausted, to let the pen still move on. by some called the ghost of wit, delighting to walk after the death of its body. And to say the truth, there seems to be no part of knowledge in fewer hands than that of discerning when to have done. By the time that an author has written out a book, he and his readers are become old acquaintance, and grow very loath to part, so that I have sometimes known it to be in writing as in visiting, where the ceremony of taking leave has employed more time than the whole conversation before. The conclusion of a treatise resembles the conclusion of human life, which has sometimes been compared to the end of a feast, where few are satisfied to depart ut plenis vidi conviva. For men will sit down after the fullest meal, though it be only to dose, or to sleep out the rest of the day. But in this latter I differ extremely from other writers, and shall be too proud if, by all my labors, I can have any ways contributed to the repose of mankind in times so turbulent and unquiet as these. Neither do I think such an employment so very alien from the office of a wit as some would suppose. For among a very polite nation in Greece 157, there were the same temples built and consecrated to sleep and the muses, between which two deities they believed the strictest friendship was established. I have one concluding favor to request of my reader, that he will not expect to be equally diverted and informed by every line or every page of this discourse, but give some allowance to the author's spleen, and short fits or intervals of dullness, as well as his own, and lay it seriously to his conscience whether, if he were walking the streets in dirty weather or a rainy day, he would allow it fair dealing in folks at their ease from a window, to criticize his gait and ridicule his dress at such a juncture. In my disposure of employments of the brain, I have thought fit to make invention the master, and to give method and reason the office of its lackeys. The cause of this distribution was from observing it my peculiar case, to be often under a temptation of being witty upon occasion, where I could be neither wise nor sound, nor anything to the matter in hand. And I am too much a servant of the modern way, to neglect any such opportunities, whatever pains or improprieties I may be at to introduce them. For I have observed that from a laborious collection of 738 flowers and shining hints of the best modern authors, digested with great reading into my book of commonplaces, I have not been able after 5 years to draw, hook, or force into common conversation any more than a dozen. Of which dozen the one moiety failed of success by being dropped among unsuitable company, and the other cost me so many strains, and traps, and damages to introduce, that I at length resolved to give it over. Now this disappointment, to discover a secret, I must own, gave me the first hint of setting up for an author, and I have since found among some particular friends, that it has become a very general complaint, and has produced the same effects upon many others. For I have remarked many a two-wordly word, to be wholly neglected or despised in discourse, which hath passed very smoothly with some consideration and esteem after its preferment and sanction in print. But now, since, by the liberty and encouragement of the press, I am grown absolute master of the occasions and opportunities to expose the talents I have acquired, I already discover that the issues of my observanda begin to grow too large for the receipts. Therefore I shall here pause a while, till I find, by feeling the world's pulse and my own, that it will be of absolute necessity for us both to resume my pen. In some early editions of The Tale of a Tub, Swift added, under the title of Hat Follows After Section X, the following sketch for a History of Martin. The History of Martin. Giving an account of his departure from Jack, and their setting up for themselves, on which account they were obliged to travel, and meet many disasters. Finding no shelter near Peter's habitation, Martin succeeds in the north. Peter thunders against Martin for the loss of the large revenue he used to receive from thence. Harry Huff sent Marlin a challenge in fight, which he received. Peter rewards Harry for the pretended victory, which encouraged Harry to huff Peter also, with many other extraordinary adventures of the said Martin in several places with many considerable persons. With a digression concerning the nature, usefulness, and necessity of wars and quarrels. How Jack and Martin, being parted, set up each for himself. How they traveled over hills and dales, met many disasters, suffered much from the good cause, and struggled with difficulties and wants, not having where to lay their head, by all which they afterwards proved themselves to be right father's sons, and Peter to be spurious. Finding no shelter near Peter's habitation, Martin traveled northwards, and finding the Thuringians, a neighboring people, disposed to change, he set up his stage first among them, where, making it his business, to cry down Peter's powders, plasters, salves, and drugs, which he had sold a long time at a dear rate, allowing Martin none of the profit, though he had been often employed in recommending and putting them off. The good people, willing to save their pence, began to hearken to Martin's speeches. How several great lords took the hint, and on the same account declared for Martin, particularly one who, not having had enough of one wife, wanted to marry a second, and knowing Peter used not to grant such licenses, but at a swinging price, he struck up a bargain with Martin, whom he found more tractable, and who assured him he had the same power to allow such things. How most of the other northern lords, for their own private ends, withdrew themselves and their dependents from Peter's authority, and closed in with Martin. How Peter, enraged at the loss of such large territories, and consequently of so much revenue, thundered against Martin, and sent out the strongest and most terrible of his bulls to devour him. But this having no effect, and Martin defending himself boldly and dexterously, Peter at last put forth proclamations declaring Martin and all his adherents rebels and traitors, ordaining and requiring all his loving subjects to take up arms, and to kill, burn, and destroy all and every one of them, promising large rewards, and see, upon which ensued bloody wars and desolation. How Harry Huff, 160, Lord of Albion, one of the greatest bullies of those days, sent a cartel to Martin, to fight him on a stage at Cudgels, Quarterstaff, Baxword, and see hence the origin of that genteel custom of prize fighting so well known and practiced to this day among those polite islanders, though unknown everywhere else. How Martin, being a bold, blustering fellow, accepted the challenge. How they met and fought, to the great diversion of the spectators. And, after giving one another broken heads, and many bloody wounds and bruises, how they both drew off victorious, in which their example has been frequently imitated by great clerks and others since that time. How Martin's friends applauded his victory, and how Lord Harry's friends complimented him on the same score, and particularly Lord Peter, who sent him a fine feather for his cap 160b, to be worn by him, and his successors as a perpetual mark for his bold defense of Lord Peter's cause. How Harry, flushed with his pretended victory over Martin, began to huff Peter also, and at last downright quarreled with him about a wench. How some of Lord Harry's tenants, ever fond of changes, began to talk kindly of Martin, for which he mauled them soundly, as he did also those that adhered to Peter. How he turned some out of house and hold, others he hanged or burnt, and see how Harry Huff, after a deal of blustering, wenching, and bullying, died, and was succeeded by a good-natured boy 161, who, giving way to the general bent of his tenants, allowed Martin's notions to spread everywhere, and take deep root in ambition. How, after his death, the farm fell into the hands of a lady 161b, who was violently in love with Lord Peter. How she purged the whole country with fire and sword, resolved not to leave the name or remembrance of Martin. How Peter triumphed, and set up shops again for selling his own powders, plasters, and salves, which were now declared the only true ones, Martin's being all declared counterfeit. How great numbers of Martin's friends left the country, and, traveling up and down in foreign parts, grew acquainted with many of Jack's followers, and took a liking to many of their notions and ways, which they afterwards brought back into ambition. Now under another landlady, 161c, more moderate and more cunning than the former, how she endeavored to keep friendship both with Peter and Martin. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.